more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
There's actually photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
You're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Jenna Fryer.
And I'm Lisa Hildebrand. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students and postdoctoral fellows in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student or a postdoc at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to learn and find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and podcast pages.
This episode of Inspiration Dissemination was pre-recorded, and our guest on the show is Kayla Fratt, a first-year PhD student in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Sciences. Welcome, Kayla.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We're excited to have you on the show, Kayla. To sort of set the stage, can you tell our listeners, sort of big picture, what is it that your PhD research is about?
Yeah, so I use conservation detection dogs to find scat, so feces, of carnivores, mostly apex predators, and we're using those scat samples to answer questions about the diet and movement of these predators in fragmented landscapes. So basically, what that means is that my dogs and I travel to Alaska and then are working in an archipelago, so a bunch of islands in Southeast Alaska, studying wolves. And then we will also be traveling to El Salvador, where we're studying pumas and then a bunch of other mid-sized wild cats down there.
I guess to get started with like basic definitions, what is a conservation detection dog?
Yeah, so a conservation detection dog is a dog that is specially trained to sniff out things that are hard to find for biologists. So in a lot of cases, this is scat. It also can be wild animals. It can also be carcasses. And in some cases, it's even things like diseases, insects, parasites. There's quite a bit of variety, but really our bread and butter is mostly scat.
And as you told Jenna and me before our interview, is that, you know, typically when you want to employ conservation detection dogs, a project will sort of hire a consultant who trains and owns the dogs. But you train and own your own dogs. So tell us about your two dogs. Who are they? Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, to be clear, I guess I used to be one of those consultants, and then I have since decided that I want to get a PhD so that I get to kind of design my own studies and be more involved in the science. I loved the kind of itinerant life of showing up with my dogs and doing whatever project it was, but I think I'm kind of ready to have a little bit more of a hand in the scientific questions and the methodologies. So I have two working detection dogs right now. They're both border collies. So one is Barley. He's 10 years old. I adopted him from a shelter in Denver when he was about 3. And he's been with me for so far 100% of my career. He's my main guy. We call him our heart dogs in the industry. He's like my soulmate dog. And then there's Niffler, who is just over 3 years old right now. He's also a border collie. I got him from a breeder in Idaho. And he is like everything that a purpose-bred dog should be. He's like super fit, super healthy, super goofy, friendly, and just smart as a whip. I love him so much as well. I always struggle. It sounds like Barley is my favorite, and he might kind of be, but they're both my favorite.
So what does the process of training one of these dogs entail?
Yeah. So generally, you know, the first step is finding the right dog for the job. So just like training any person for any job, first you need to hire the right person, and hopefully you do a good job of selecting the right person for that job, because not all of us want to be CIA agents or bank tellers or construction workers. So what we start out with is we look for dogs that are going to be physically capable of doing the job at hand. Depending on the job, this might be a larger or smaller dog, but generally for like my dogs are general purpose. Again, I was a consultant, so they needed to be able to do a variety of things. So I look for kind of medium-sized dogs, you know, like 40 to 60 pounds. I don't want a dog that I can't carry out of the field if something goes wrong. And I also don't want a dog that is so small that they can't keep up if we're doing miles and miles over the day. And then we're looking for dogs that are like absolutely bonkers for toys. That's kind of our starting point, because what we're looking for is a dog that is so into their ball or their frisbee or their tug, that we can use that to convince them to continue working for us, even when the days are long or hard or rainy, or there's a squirrel that just ran by. But don't worry about it. They would rather have their ball. And, you know, most dogs, that's not their thing. They'd rather chase the squirrel. So we're really looking for that kind of unusual dog. And then what we're going to start teaching them is, hey, this odor that you're sniffing, this makes your ball happen, or your tug happen, or your frisbee happen. And that's kind of the root of it. That's the easy part. And then from there, teaching them how to problem solve and how to actually find odor after, you know, they'll kind of like encounter odor. Like if you can imagine smelling your neighbor's barbecue when you're still a block away, but then actually sourcing it to exactly where it's coming from. That's the hard part. And that's where the training gets a lot more difficult. But that's kind of the broad strokes.
And are all detection dogs trained on this toy motivation or toy method, or is that just one that you prefer?
Broadly, yes. Traditionally, in the police dog, working dog world, all of these dogs are just trained with toys. But that's changing a little bit culturally right now. There's a little bit more understanding that you can have a dog that's motivated to work for food instead, and that can work really, really well. Personally, both of my dogs are toy guys. I like that. I think it's fun. I find that sort of training really exciting. But my co-founders at Canine Conservationists, which is the organization that I run, still part-time, two of the three other dogs that we have at that organization will work for toys or food. One of the others is just a toy guy as well.
Right. And you said in part, it's because, you know, if you're rewarding your dog for finding, for sniffing out, you know, a scent with bacon bits, for example, then you're probably sort of time limited as to how many things mm-hmm. you can, or for how long you can search for. Because at some point, yeah, your dog's going to have a tummy ache from all the bacon.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, if it's something maybe not quite as rich as bacon, you could also get into the situation where if you're in the field for 6 months at a time and the dog is getting that many treats every day, it's really hard to keep a dog in good shape if you're giving them something that's high enough value, because we can't pay for kibble, pay for the sort of work with kibble usually. That's just not usually exciting enough to the dogs to, again, continue ignoring squirrels and bunnies and deer and all of these other really exciting things that happen in the environment.
So you said that dogs for various purposes are trained kind of using this method. So how does the training or like the tasks differ between your conservation dogs and ones that are maybe for law enforcement or other areas?
Yeah, so I would say that within the other detection dog, the rest of the detection dog world, you know, we've got bomb dogs, drug dogs, search and rescue dogs. Those are kind of our big other groups. Our dogs in conservation are most similar to like wilderness search and rescue dogs. So those are dogs that are going out in the woods and looking for missing hikers, because they're also covering really large, rugged areas looking for something out in the woods. But there are some really big differences with that as well. When you're looking for a single missing person, that tends to be a ton of odor. So the dogs are able to detect that person from much farther away. And they're usually only looking for one person or maybe a group of people that you're hoping, presuming are still together. Versus when we're out, we might be finding dozens of targets in a day. And our detection distance, which is, again, that distance away that the dog actually is able to perceive that odor, is usually a lot smaller than what you see with wilderness search and rescue. And then when you go over to bomb and drug dogs, I'm not generally looking for things that other human beings are trying to hide from me and my dog. So I don't have to try to think about what someone who is trying to blow up a stadium would do in order to conceal all of that C4 or something like that. There are people in the conservation dog world who work in anti-poaching units. So those guys do have to think about that. But I don't work in trafficking or poaching. So I don't have to worry about that generally. And then when you think about the drug dogs in particular, those dogs are used for probable cause and standing up in court. And your training records can be subpoenaed and you can be cross-examined regarding the efficacy of your dog. And that's not something I anticipate ever needing to do in my career. I could see it maybe happening. You know, we know how things get about spotted owls and some of these other sorts of things. It could happen in conservation, but it's not like it's not likely the way that like any drug dog in its career is relatively likely to. That's the whole point, is that something ends up in court at some point.
And so you just mentioned a lot of things that you are maybe not having to do when you train your dogs. But as we learned, there are some very interesting techniques that you're almost having to train yourself. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, how you, a human who's, you know, odor perception is not as well developed as a dog's, like how you try and design training for your dogs in order for them to have somewhat realistic, you know, scenarios in training as they would encounter in the wild.
Yeah, absolutely. This is where things really get interesting to me and what I really love getting to talk about. So thank you for asking this question. Because at the very basic, so Barley, my older dog, is about to start learning how to sniff out wolf scat. That's really simple. We have like a bunch of identical PVC pipe snorkels is what we call them. So it's kind of like an elbow of a PVC pipe. They're all identical. I'll put the wolf scat in one. He sniffs. When he finds the wolf scat, I use a clicker. So that makes a sound that he knows. That means his ball is coming. We do that a couple times. Really easy to teach him that, like, yeah, out of this group of six identical items, I want you to tell me about the wolf. That's the easy part, really, usually. Now, what we need to start being able to do is getting the dogs to understand how to go from that moment where they first detect odor to actually finding the source. Because having my dog tell me that a jaguar was once here does not give me genetic material that I need to actually figure out what the jaguar was eating and whether or not that jaguar is lactating and, you know, who that jaguar is. You know, I can't do much with that. So we do need them to actually find the item in most cases. And that's where things get interesting. So I think there's a really good comparison here if we look at Niffler, my younger dog's career. So Niffler has worked two seasons so far on a wind farm. And on the wind farms, we're working under the turbines looking for birds and bats that have been killed by the turbines. And there, it's very windy, it's very flat, and there's not generally a ton of vegetation. You know, there might be corn or soy or prairie, but it's not super varied in most cases. So if you can imagine like a plume of smoke going across a prairie like that, it's going to be in a straight line. And basically what the dogs can do is we work perpendicular to the wind. So the wind is kind of hitting me on the side of the face. And whenever they hit that odor, all they have to do is turn 90 degrees, follow it upwind. And once they no longer smell it, then they've overshot it. You kind of see them then circle back and then they can usually pinpoint it. It's very straightforward for them. So that's great. That's a huge part of our work. And it's a great place for a young dog to start out. It's an amazing place to teach a dog to love this game, because a huge part of my job as well is to make sure that the dogs always think that they are brilliant and smart and they've got this, because I can't really give them a pep talk. They need to love this job. I can't make them do it. So it's really nice to have those jobs that are straightforward. So then we can get to another example. So I was a consultant back about a year ago for Ellen Dimmitt, who is also in my lab here at OSU. She's also in Tal Levy's lab here. And there I was actually hired to help search out for all of the scats of these carnivores for some diet research that she was doing. So there we're in the dense jungle in Guatemala. And what we get there is there might be wind up above the canopy, but down at dog nose height, there doesn't tend to be a lot of wind movement, or it might be kind of paradoxical. It might be really broken up. And then we also have really dense vegetation, which kind of breaks up that odor. And so if you can imagine that same scent plume or smoke plume, it would be kind of all broken up. There might be chunks of it going off. It might be eddying. And then if you've got sun coming through, so say in a place where a tree has fallen and now you've got direct sunlight in one area, that's causing that dark vegetation to heat up. That odor is rising and it's creating a thermal. So then it's pulling all of our scent in and sending it up to the clouds, totally useless for us. So you can imagine that in that situation, it was much more common for the dogs to kind of encounter odor and then have to basically do like 3D chess to figure out where it was coming from. And we saw a lot more like intensive sniffing. The dogs are needing to circle. They're like checking clumps of vegetation and doing this like really intense, like, you know, like blowing out really hard and then needing to like go check elsewhere. And, you know, and then it's our job to just kind of like step back and wait and let them problem solve and maybe sometimes use our primate brains to think through like, okay, so I see that there's direct sunlight over here. So maybe if I move him over here, that'll like help him encounter odor. But the dogs are really kind of the experts here. And the reason that they're experts is because in training, I'm constantly trying to think of like, what is the lesson that my dog needs to work on this week or this month? And how can I look out my backyard or look at this park that we're training in and think about what the wind is doing, whether or not it's raining, because it's always raining here. Whether or not that maybe it is sunny like today as we're recording, but a cloud might blow over the sun and then again change all of these scenting conditions. So how do I plan all of that out to then put the target where I want it to be so that the odor moves in a way that the odor teaches the dog the lesson I want the dog to learn? It starts getting a little crazy making to try to like predict all of these different levels of like, okay, so what is the sun and the wind and the terrain and the vegetation all going to do in relation to my target odor? And then how is my dog going to react? Because sometimes I set something up that I think is going to work great. And then the dog takes a left when I expected them to take a right. And then all of a sudden they're approaching the puzzle from the wrong angle. And it's way harder than it should have been or way easier than it should have been. And that's okay. You know, it's just like teaching anyone anything. You're trying to figure out how to ratchet up that difficulty in a way that's fair to them. And again, maintains that confidence and joy for them, ideally, while still teaching them the lesson and making sure that they're continuing to improve.
I think that's so fascinating, all of the nuance that you as the trainer have to think about and understand. I mean, we're getting into like physics here, understanding fluid dynamics. And I thought you, earlier today, you mentioned an example of how you try to visualize how scent might move. Tell the listeners about that, because I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. So one of the things that I do a lot is, so right after 4th of July, I will go to fireworks stores and I will pick up a bunch of discount smoke bombs. A lot of times it's like $3 for $6. It's a great deal. And then I store them in the back of the work truck or whatever. So then when I'm going out and when I'm going out to train, I will look at a situation and try to think, okay, what do I think the odor is going to do here? What do I think the wind is doing? Because the wind and the odor are more or less synonymous in these situations. And then I can try to convince myself to be clear about what I think is going to happen. And then I can go and set off a smoke bomb and watch what actually happens and use that to kind of continually iterate. And when I'm getting really crazy about this, so I did, along with my co-founders at Canine Conservationists, we teach an online course for people who want to learn to train their own detection dogs. We have gone so far as letting the dog search an area for a target. And then as soon as the dog has found the target, we set off a smoke bomb. So then you can hypothetically see how the dog responded to the odor. And then you can actually physically see what the odor was doing. And those have been really, really helpful lessons. And I try to do it all the time just for my own learning as well, because again, it's so hard. I can't smell what they're, I mean, obviously if I like put a jaguar scat under my face, I can smell it, but I can't smell it from 3 meters away, from 10 meters away, or from 40 meters away, but the dogs can. So, you know, it's so hard to, like, I can't see the wind, I can't smell the scat, and I'm just doing the best I can to try to understand the physics and these like microclimates. And, you know, and then also knowing that it's never going to be perfect. These are really, really complicated dynamic systems and things can change. One of the things that blew me away when I started doing the smoke bomb situation was that the smoke bomb experiments was how dynamic it can be. And you would watch sometimes the smoke going off and it was doing exactly what I thought. And then the wind shifts And then it shifts back. And then all of a sudden you've got a plume of smoke that has moved way away from the rest of it and is just like kind of floating out into the wilderness alone. And it's just like, oh my God, that's why sometimes my dog does this like weird thing where he looks like he's seen a ghost for a second, but then is lost and can't find the odor again. And it's like, oh yeah, because that can happen with just the wind shifting by like 30 degrees for 2 seconds and then shifting back. It's crazy how dynamic these systems are.
It seems like at the end of all of this, your dog should get a PhD as well.
I mean, that's my hope. I've talked to my advisor about that a couple times, and I hope he knows I'm serious about it.
So this is a very long process to get to where you are, both with your dogs and also just personally becoming a trainer. So how does one become a dog detection trainer, and how have you gotten here in your career?
Yeah, so as far as actually getting into this field, there isn't like a well-established path. There's no school that you can go to major in conservation detection dog training. And even if you wanted to major in like detection dog training, most of that is actually done through like police or military academies. So you actually have to go through boot camp or selection processes for that first, and then maybe you get selected for that. So you can't even like maybe do that first and then use that to step sideways into conservation. I suppose you could, but it would be a very long, hard process. So what I personally did is I went to undergrad at Colorado College, and I was getting a degree in ecology there, and I was working my way through school. I was always someone who really loved animals. I grew up on a farm, mostly with like bunnies and chickens and cats, but we did have a dog starting when I was in about fifth grade. And I loved animal behavior. I loved animal training. I loved all of those things. Like, part of what I love about conservation is the animals, obviously. So I got a job as a dog trainer. And then by the time I was about a junior in undergrad, people were starting to ask me, Kayla, why are you looking at grad school? Why are you looking at these seasonal field tech jobs that pay nothing and require you to live out of a tent for months at a time? And then you're jobless again. And I was like, I don't know. I love conservation. Like, help. I don't know. That's what I want to do. And people kept being like, but Kayla, you're good at dog training and you could just have a job doing that. And at the time I was getting a degree in ecology, but I had sweet talked my way into taking all of these like 400 level neuroscience and psychology classes. So I was taking like learning and adaptive behavior and cognition and neuroethology and like all of these classes alongside, you know, ornithology and mammalogy and my normal ecology classes. So I was really having this kind of crisis junior year of undergrad. And I was just like, I have no idea. I don't know what I'm going to do because I really am passionate about conservation. But my day to day was really taken up with dog training and animal behavior at the time. I wasn't totally locked in on dogs specifically yet. I actually had a period of time where I really thought I wanted to be a comparative cognition researcher. I wanted to like study how smart birds are and why birds can solve puzzles and those sorts of things. And then someone sent me a YouTube video about the dogs that sniff out orca scat on the Salish Sea. And I just immediately was like, this is it. I get to train the dogs. I get to use all of this expertise that I've been building in dog training. I get to have this really unique, intimate relationship with an animal, which is, again, one of the things that drew me to conservation. Although I had already realized that I wasn't going to get to be Jane Goodall. I wasn't going to get to be like hanging out with Flo and David Greybeard and like all of these named chimps that she had personal relationships with. That's just not really how most conservation careers go anymore. But I wasn't going to like, quote unquote, just be a dog trainer. I was going to get to do all of those things that I really loved on the day to day, but know that I was doing it for the mission of conservation. So then, of course, I immediately sat down and I emailed every single organization I could find on the internet and asked them if they took interns, if they took volunteers, like what classes should I be taking during my last year of undergrad? Like, please, please, please hire me. You know, what do I have to do? And I got really bummer responses. You know, everyone was like, oh, we don't take interns, we don't take volunteers, end of story. Some said that they don't like hiring dog trainers and they don't recommend going that route. And I already had too much dog training experience, so they weren't interested in me. It was really negative, really, really discouraging. And nobody had any solutions for where I could go to maybe try and get an internship and try to get into this field. So, you know, I was kind of like, okay, well, I don't really know what to do. So I got a couple different jobs after undergrad, kind of continuing to move around in conservation. I worked at a shelter as an animal behaviorist for a while. I did web design. I started a podcast. I was blogging. I was like, I had all of these different types of jobs kind of in only a 3-year period is what all of this took. And then, but the whole time I was just like, conservation dogs, this is it. This is what I need to be doing. So I started writing a Fulbright grant to go to New Zealand and study conservation detection dogs because New Zealand is actually where these dogs were first pioneered, where this process first started. And through the process of writing this Fulbright grant, I connected with Working Dogs for Conservation. And I kind of asked them basically, like, what are some of your pain points as an organization? What are some of the things that are hard for you guys? And maybe I can make my Fulbright into something that would help answer those questions for y'all, which turned out to be brilliant. I wasn't necessarily plotting all of this out, but ultimately they reached out to me when I was a semifinalist in the Fulbright process and asked if I would be interested in a job with them. And they were in the process of creating a communications and outreach coordinator position. And because of my experience in web design and podcasting and blogging, but also knowing that I had that relationship with them and I had the ecology and dog training background, they asked if I wanted the job. And I was like, absolutely, of course. At the time, I was living in Panama. So I like boxed up Barley and me, and we flew back to the US and we moved into Montana. And I was like, I've made it. Like, I'm going to retire here. I'm buying a house. Like, I am never leaving. This is amazing. They're like one of the best organizations in the world for this sort of work. Really, really world renowned. I managed to get myself a lateral move eventually into a position called a canine field specialist. So then I really was like training the dogs, doing the field work. I still was managing quite a bit of communications and outreach, but I managed to get more into what I actually wanted to be doing. And then I lost the job during COVID. And I thought that was it. I was like, okay, do I like go into tech writing? Like I was thinking about all sorts of crazy sideways moves at that point. And then instead, I ended up starting Canine Conservationists. I've got two amazing co-founders. But it's been an absolute whirlwind. It's a really, really hard field to get into, and it's something that I am really, really passionate about because the world has so many dogs and people who would be excellent at this job, and conservation needs all the helping hands it can get. So, we didn't talk about this during the pre-interview, but like that's why we Canine Conservationist has a course. It's we spend way more time doing education and outreach and trying to help other people get into this line of work because I know how hard it was for me, and I was someone who had all the desire in the world, and clearly I've managed to make it happen, but it shouldn't be that hard. There are plenty of people who would be amazing at this job who don't have the luck and the entrepreneur skills and the computer science side of things. Like you shouldn't have to do that to get into this line of work. So I'm really passionate about that. I don't know if that was your question at all, but that's there we are.
I have to say, it's super inspiring to hear, like, when, as an undergrad, when I think we're like bursting with energy and excitement, and then to have so many people tell you, no, like you've already gone down the wrong path. We don't offer internships for you to, keep at it, keep the dream alive, and then through all your other skills, get there in the end. I think it's a really great story, and I love to hear what you do at Canine Conservationists to try and enable more people to get in to this career that, was difficult for that, you had doors closed on you essentially.
Exactly. And again, there's no reason to make it hard for people who want to do something that's this important. Like it, I do think it is smart. Like whenever I talk to, because I now get these emails. Now I'm the one who gets the emails from people being like, "Oh my God, can I intern for you?" And I have to say, no, we don't currently offer internships. But here are some resources I can give you. Like that's really important that I'm able to do that second half. And I also do think it's really important when I'm talking to, these undergrads or, maybe people older later in life, and even sometimes I get emails from high schoolers or middle schoolers. It's to be like, okay, but let's also talk realistically about what this career entails because it is hard. there are parts of this that are really, really, really tough. I have been very poor and very itinerant for a very long time. And I think being really honest with people about what that is, because it's really easy to look at the Instagrammable parts of conservation detection dog work and be like, oh my God, this is the coolest job in the world. And it absolutely is. I love my job so much. And there are a lot of downsides that I'm willing to live with that I think people do need to be realistic about considering whether or not those are downsides that they are able to live with.
And so pivoting a little bit to the application of your dogs as this phenomenal conservation tool into your two research projects that you've explained to us, one in Alaska where you're trying to detect wolf scat and one in El Salvador where you're trying to detect puma scat. Can you tell us what you're obviously bringing your dogs into these, wild places? What are some of the considerations you have to, make in order, to bring your dog into the into your dogs into, that landscape? And what are you sort of aware of when you bring them there?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is really, really important. Obviously, I love my dogs. They sleep in my bed. You all can see, nobody else can, but like I've got statues of my dog above my bed. Like I love my dogs so much. And all I ever want is for them to be like happy and fulfilled and safe. And also, like purely economically, if one of my dogs gets hurt, I can't do my job. And I can't just go to the store and buy another one and have it ready to go. So safety is really, really huge for us. So in Alaska, the biggest concerns we've got are mostly bears. We're going to be in an area with no brown bears, but a lot of black bears, and they are big black bears up there. And then we also are obviously going to be around wolves. We will also be traveling on a boat. So there's just a lot of boat safety and cold and wet and those sorts of environmental issues. But the big scary thing is bears. So there, most of our surveys are going to be taking place on these beaches in the intertidal zone. So we'll have pretty good visibility and should be able to more or less see where the big predators are before we bump into them and before we surprise each other. And if and when we're working in areas that are a little bit denser, then we'll be working with Barley on a long leash. So I have these like fancy biothane leashes. It's like a plasticky faux leather that is really great for working in cold, wet, muddy conditions. And we'll be able to work with him on that. He's used to it. And then we also spend a ton of time training the dogs to not interact with wildlife. So if and when we do see something, I don't expect Barley to be the one to start anything. So that's Alaska. There is stuff to worry about there, but I've also been living in Montana for a lot of my life, and a lot of my career as a conservation dog handler has been based out of Montana. So there's not a lot of things that are completely different and new to me in Alaska versus Montana, especially in this part of Alaska, because again, we don't have like polar bears or Kodiaks or something like that. Then once we get down to El Salvador, it would be really odd to have an interaction with a puma down there. There are just so few of them. And through interactions with the community down there, it seems like nobody is losing dogs or livestock to these pumas. These pumas are so far kind of behaving themselves and eating wild animals exclusively. And even through community interviews, through Fundación Naturaleza El Salvador, I haven't been doing this. It seems like nobody's really seeing these pumas either. They're showing up on camera traps, but they're pretty sneaky. So I'm not super worried about the pumas. But in El Salvador, the big thing I worry about is snakes. So I'm a little bit of a snake venom nerd. I attended the Denver Venom Conference last year, which like was mostly ER docs and like ambulance drivers from Namibia learning how to deal with, snake bites when you're way out away from the ER, or like, people talking about the pros and cons of like different types of anti-venom and how they interact with different types of toxins. Fascinating stuff, but what I was there for was just to figure out like what are the people, again, these like paramedics in Namibia doing to stabilize and care for their patients when they're really, really far away from an amazing hospital? Because that's the situation that we're often in. We might be 18 hours away from a hospital. And even the best hospitals in San Salvador are not necessarily super well equipped for snake bite emergencies, let alone then the veterinarians and whether or not they're ready to take care of the dogs. So I carry anti-venom with us in the field. I was able to purchase some and get trained on it from a veterinarian in Costa Rica. That anti-venom works for most of the scary snakes down in Central America, except for the coral snakes. So if we have any problems with bushmasters, fertilances, most of the rattlesnakes, we do have anti-venom that'll help kind of tide us over until we're able to get to primary care. And I'm just a huge first aid nerd, honestly. Like, I'm taking a wilderness first responder course starting tomorrow. I've been continuously certified in wilderness first responder for about 9 years, and then it lapsed accidentally last year, so I have to retake the full course. But it's just really important to me whenever I'm out on one of these field crews that someone needs to be trained to about the highest level that you can be without going to a lot of school for it. And I am on 100% of the field crews that I'm on, so I make sure that I'm certified.
So as we're coming towards the end of this interview, we do have three traditions on this show. So the first tradition is we like to ask all of our guess what their favorite thing about their research is.
Oh my gosh. I mean, obviously it's just getting to bring my dogs. Like, I get kind of emotional, and just like, it's so awe-inspiring to get to watch my dogs work and to get to work cooperatively with this other species that, you know, like, we have co-evolved for thousands of years with dogs, and they have this superpower that I am just barely scratching the surface of trying to understand. And then they're able to do that to help in the conservation fight, and they just think we're out playing the best game in the world. And it's so cool. You know, they have no idea we're working. They just think that we're going out to play the best game. And then we get to come home and we're all tired and buggy and filthy. And then we get to go to bed and we get to do it again. It's amazing.
That it really does sound amazing. I've loved getting to learn about what it means to be a, you know, conservation detection dog trainer and owner. Anyway, our second tradition on the show is that we ask you to give a piece of advice. So tell us what your piece of advice is and who it's for, if there's a specific group of people.
Yeah, I don't know exactly who this is for, and I don't know what the one-liner would be, but something around being willing to take those detours and kind of following your passions, even if they feel disjointed, or it feels like you're on a weird detour. You know, I've, again, going back to like web design, I absolutely did not think that that was going to be my calling, but it was the thing that got me into the conservation dog field ultimately. And like, I've learned diesel mechanic skills along the way, and driving stick shift and speaking Spanish and rock climbing has helped get me jobs before. You know, like, it's okay to have a ton of varied interests, and you'll be amazed how you can sometimes find common roots and ways to put those to use elsewhere as well.
Well, Kayla, thank you so much for all of this fascinating information. I have learned so much. And so our final tradition on the show is that you get to pick your outro song. So what song did you pick and why?
Yeah, so I picked the song Soñar Contigo by Charlie Rod. It's just the song that's been stuck in my head a lot lately. And it's kind of this beautiful song about dreaming of someone and being somewhere with someone. And I've been actually thinking about it a lot as I'm getting ready for the field season and dreaming of getting to go out and be in the woods again with my dog.
Well, thanks so much, Kayla, for coming on. It's been a pleasure. And up next is Kayla's choice of song, Soñar Contigo. Thanks so much, Kayla.
Yeah, thank you.
Yo sé que el mundo te acercó a mí, y es que te juro que no soy sin ti. Me muero por por mostrar de todo lo que soy. Y es que hasta en mi inconsciente puedo darte amor. Otra vez vuelvo a soñar contigo. Un mundo tan lejos al tuyo.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, tell your friends about it and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at KBVRID.
This theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline and the intro jingle was created by Olin Hamann. Special thanks to the supporting staff at KBVR that allow this show and podcast to be possible.
This show was started by Jean Kamvar and Joey Hulbert in 2012. To learn about our current hosts, other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, visit our website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. Thanks again for listening, and stay curious, my friends.